Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange Open Mic session. Today's Open Mic topic is Security in WebSphere Message Broker. My name is Joseph Lam, and this session will give you the opportunity to speak to our panel of experts on a variety of subjects related to today's topic. Moving on to slide number 2. In today's Open Mic session, we will begin by introducing to you our panel of experts for the call. We will then move on to give you a brief introduction to security in WebSphere Message Broker. Next, our panel of experts will answer questions that were pre-submitted to us via email. Then we will open the lines for a live question and answer period. And lastly, the session will end with a summary of this Open Mic session. Moving on to slide number 3. At this time, I would like to introduce to you our panel of experts for today. Our panel consists of Vivek Grover, WebSphere Message Broker, L2 Support Specialist.
Good morning, everyone.
Next, we have Ralph Bateman, WebSphere Message Broker and MQ Series Serviceability Architect.
Good morning, everybody.
Then we have David Coles, WebSphere Message Broker, Level 3 Service Specialist.
Good morning, everybody.
And finally, we have Randy Mueller, WebSphere Message Broker, Level 2 Service Specialist.
Hello, everyone.
Thank you, Randy. Before we get to the question and answer period, one of our panelists for today would like to give you a technical overview of the topic. I will now move on to slide number 4 and pass the presentation over to Vivek. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Joseph. Hello, everyone. This is Vivek Grover from Broker Level 2. We're on slide number 4. Well, I see a lot of familiar names on the screen here. Thanks all for joining. So today's topic is security in WebSphere Message Broker. As diverse as it sounds, security in Message Broker can be split into several areas, as we see on the chart. The first one on the top is message flow security, which is message-based security, where you authenticate and you authorize the identity of a message entering the message flow or the broker world. So each message entering the broker world is authenticated or authorized or however you configure it. Then we have WS security and HTTPS that are meant for securing web services. While HTTPS security secures the HTTP transactions, using HTTP input or HTTP request node relies mainly on SSL or secure sockets layer with the transport level security. WS security is used for SOAP nodes for securing, again, the web services based on techniques such as encryption or what we refer to as confidentiality or signatures, or what we refer to as integrity and authentication. This is also a kind of message based security for web services. Slide number 5, please. So Message Broker also has the security for performing the configuration tasks and administrative tasks on the broker and broker resources, like creation of broker using MQSI create broker command, the authorization needed to perform such kinds of tasks on the system and as well as on the broker fall under this category, the authorization for configuration tasks. Then the next one down, we have security for the toolkit users that are coming either locally or remotely or coming through the domain, connecting to the config manager through ACLs. Through the ACL definitions on the config manager, you can authorize the users, the toolkit users, and give them access to your config manager or broker resources. And like I said, it pertains to both domain or local security. Next one here we have is security for securing the PubSub domain. These services are based on message protection, topic-based security with username servers, and authentication with respect to real-time nodes. I do want to mention that, as some of you may have noticed, this is not a comprehensive list, but generally covers most of the security configurations that fall under these categories. And as we move forward, we will be discussing some questions that pertain to some of these security areas, some at a high level and some in depth. And any follow-up questions that you may have will be addressed during the live Q&A session. So with this, let me hand over the session back to Joseph so we can move forward.
Thank you, Vivek. We will now begin our question and answer session with questions that were pre-submitted to us before the webcast. I will now advance to slide number 6 and hand the presentation over to our panel of experts.
Thank you again, Joseph. This is Vivek again. So we're on slide number 6. The first question today is, what is message flow security in Message Broker 6.1? So I'm going to go over a high-level overview of message flow security first, then we'll take a look at how this security works, how the message flows through this message flow, which is configured for message-based security, and then we'll just quickly look at the configuration that is needed on the broker to make this work. Message flow, message-based security, was introduced in FixPack 3 of version 6.1. Basically, this is configured at the broker level, and any specific message flows or any specific nodes in the message flows that need to use this will just point to this configuration. Now, once this flow is deployed through the bar file, it checks for the identity in the incoming message. And depending on the configuration, the security profile configuration, you can check for authentication or authorization for this message, for this identity in the message, if you will. If the identity in the message matches, then the message is propagated forward. If the identity does not match with the credentials defined, then the message basically fails to get processed. So as the FOIL reads to enable message flow security, it enables the identity-based control processing of the individual messages in a flow. Some of the important terms are explained, are listed here. Identity being one of the important terms is what uniquely identifies an individual or an object. It can be in the, so from a message broker point of view, a username coming in or a username and a password coming in, depending on what you set as the identity. It can be in the message header or it can be in the message body. There are sourced identities and there are mapped identities, meaning the identity is either used as is or it is mapped to an alternate identity using an external security provider. The external security providers used that are supported with Message Broker this time are LDAP or TFIM. We will see a little more on the security providers as well as on the identity as we move forward. The next term is authorization, which is basically verifying the role of this identity. So whether it can access the message flow and the message flow resources. Again, external security providers, LDAP or TFIM, can be used. We also have authentication here, which is basically verifying if the incoming identity is valid or not. For example, a username in the message, is it a valid user or not? So again, for message broker security, broker passes the identity tokens to LDAP or to TFIM where the authentication takes place and the control, once the authentication is performed, the controls return back to the flow. Then we have security profile, which basically defines the configuration of message-based security. Now, what external security providers do you want to use, LDAP or TFIM, and for what purposes? Whether you want to use authentication or you want to use authorization or not, or you want to map the identity to an alternate user, or you want to simply propagate this to the subsequent nodes, everything is configured in this security profile. So basically this is one point of definition of security operations that are to be performed on the identity within the message flow. It can be created in the toolkit, or it can be created using command line NQSI create configurable service command. Again, it applies to the input nodes, output nodes, request and reply nodes in the flow. And we will see this in a little more detail as we look at the configuration. So let's move to slide number 7, please. Okay, this foil explains the working of the message flow security. I've taken this figure from the information center. The numbers that you see against the nodes, the little circle numbers, they are actually the steps in which the messages flow, the messages configured for message flow security flow through the message flow. So in step number 1, you can see a message is arriving at an input node. It could be an NQ input or an HTTP or a SOAP input node, depending on the transport being used. And the security profile at this time, which is associated with the node, indicates now whether the security is configured or not. And if it is configured, then what all is configured, meaning the combination of propagation, authentication, authorization, and mapping, and also what external security provider is to be used. Broker, again, at this time only supports LDAP and TFIM as external security providers. In step number 2, the security manager at this time extracts this identity information from the input message, the incoming message, and sets it in a group of new elements in the properties folder. Now, if you look at the figure on the top and right hand side, you would see the identity properties, the identity source type and token and password, and the same for map type and mapped token, map password, and map issued by. So these are the identity properties, the elements in which the security manager basically set these identity values or the identity parameters, and it extracts it from the input message and sets these new elements in the properties folder. Again, it can be in the message header or it can be in the body. In step number 3, at this time, if authentication was specified in your security profile, then the security manager calls the external security provider, could be LDAP or TFIM, to authenticate the identity. In step 4, we see the security manager calls the external security provider for mapping. Now, for mapping, only TFIM supports mapping and with message broker. So you see that's why you only see TFIM in the little box there for mapping. In step 5, we see for authorization, security manager calls the external security provider, could be LDAP or TFIM, to do the authorization of the identity. Once all this is complete, in step number 6, you see the security processing, it has finished and the control is returning back to the input node. So in step 7, we see that this message now, which has been validated and the properties have been set on this message, this message containing this properties folder with the source or mapped identities information is now sent down to the subsequent nodes in the flow. Step 8 and 9 can actually be combined here that show a compute node. Just a compute node, if you're trying to access your application database, the identity used to access this would still be your application data source ID defined using MQSI setdbforms command, or if you don't have it defined, it'll default to the data source ID and password. In step number 10, the message reaches the output node, and based on your security profile configuration, if you set the propagation definition in the identity to true, then the message, outgoing message, will contain this identity as well. So in step 11, you see finally the propagated identity is included in the appropriate message header, which is sent over, again, NQ or SOAP or HTTP transports. That pretty much covers the working of the message flow security, let's move to slide number 8, please. This foil shows the configuration needed on the broker to get this to work. As I mentioned earlier, you can use the command line or you can use the toolkit. Just for simplicity, I pulled out some snapshots from the toolkit. The picture on your left shows you a snapshot of what a security profile looks like when you invoke it in the toolkit by right-clicking your broker. There are some sample configuration properties filled in this snapshot. You'll see the authentication is set to LDAP and mapping is set to TFIM, and the authorization is also set to LDAP. Propagation is set to true here. The password can be set as plain, or you can mask it if you like, or you can obfuscate it with the hex numbers. So basically you define these external security provider configuration parameters here. You pick the configuration parameters at the top and you provide the connection information at the bottom to LDAP. You know, if you're using LDAP or you're using TFIM, you provide those connection parameters and the credentials to connect to LDAP or TFIM. If your LDAP or TFIM only authorize particular user ID to be able to connect to LDAP or, you know, to TFIM, then you also have to create that user ID in the registry using nqs.setdbfarms command for the LDAP entry or for the TFIM entry. So the user ID you specify in the registry using nqs.setdbfarms command will be used to connect to LDAP, and then the security profile configuration is validated, or the identity is then validated. You will have to get the connection parameters from your security administrator who can provide you with the base DNs and all the other connection configuration parameters or connection parameters to LDAP or TFIM. And that would be the security profile. Now, on the right-hand side, once you set the security profile, on the right-hand side, you'll see a snapshot of your NQ input node configuration from the security tab. So this snapshot captures some sample identity references that are, for instance, the application, the identity username. I mean, what kind of are you? Do you only want the identity as the username, or you want the identity set, the incoming identity as the username password, or the identity is an X509 token? So just for sample, I provided some snapshots and some values there. The token name could be, again, username or password. You can also have X509 token. The location, the identity location is the location of these identity properties in the message. So the identity property that we talked about in the previous foil, the identity token and the identity source by, or like the source identities or the password, all these identity properties are, you specify the location of this in the input node. It can be in the body or it defaults to MQMD header. You can use it in these identity properties can be in the header or they can be in the body of the message. The next one here is the password location. The password, again, this is also the location of the passwords specified in the message and the location of issued by, which is also the identity property in the message. That would be the input node configuration. The next one for the snapshot at the bottom of the screen on the right-hand bottom is that of a bar file properties. So the security profile, once you configure the security profile and you configure the input node, then you will also have to point a bar file to the security profile. So as you can see, the highlighted security profile name as security profile 3, which is what was defined on the left-hand side in the screenshot. So you're basically pointing the bar file to the security profile. And that's it. Once you save the bar file you deploy this bar file, you will see the identity coming in the incoming, in the input message, getting validated based on the configuration parameters that you have chosen, that you have specified in the profile. Now, again, I've shown these screenshots to make just to keep the thing simple and easier to understand. You can also, if you define these parameters using command line parameters, if you need details on that, feel free to email me, and I will be happy to provide that information. That's pretty much what I had for this question. With this, I hand over the session back to Joseph Lam for the next question. Thank you.
Thank you, Vivek. Now we are moving on to slide number 9, question number 2, and back to our panel of experts.
Thank you, Joseph. So it's Ralph Bacon from IBM Hursley talking now. We had a couple of questions come in, questions 2 and questions 3, that I'll take for the panel. The first question was a ZOS-specific question, but we've expanded it to show what happens on the distributed platforms as well. But the question that came in on slide 9 was, what user ID does my ZOS broker run under, and how does that relate to USS? So for those of you that are ZOS literate, the USS section is the old OMVS section of the ZOS platform, and we've used that environment to run the message broker in since we originally shipped it. Now, the way that we link the user IDs through is we do need to use a Unix type of user ID because we run under the Unix system services environment. And the way we do that, looking at the picture we've got there on slide 9, is we take the started task name, so on the screen there you should see MQ85BRK, and we take that name and we look at one of two places. We either look at the profiles in the started class, which is a recent facility that's come into ZOS, but you know, it's not that new now. Or we look at the old way of doing it, which was the started task procedure table, the ICRIN03. Whichever user ID we are returned from the started task lookup on that, we use as the owner. Now there's a big gotcha in here, and that's that the owner task, which is the user ID, and in our case that has returned us WMQI85, so that user ID must have an OMVS segment. Now the reason I've shown you the OMVS information there is because that is the Unix side. We used to call this Open Edition MVS, and it's changed to Unix System Services over time. But the OMVS segment information that we've put in there shows a valid home directory and a valid UID. And it is normally recommended that you do have a different UID to 0, because 0 is reserved for BPX root and superuser type authorities. So we set up a home directory, which then gives that user ID a home segment and a home directory, and we've got the UID. So if we move on to slide 10, then the information on slide 10 basically shows you the differences between our other platforms and the ZOS platform. So on Windows, the user ID that we run under is the one that you set up with the MQSI create broker. So the minus I there will give us the user ID, and that user ID is then used for the lifetime of that broker when you start it. On Unix, it's slightly different. The user ID that's used on the Unix platforms, and Linux is included in those, is whatever user ID you are logged into once you've done your MQSI profile and you type MQSI start. And then on ZOS, as we've just discussed, the BIPCRBK job, which is the create broker job, doesn't have the minus I like our Windows platform. So you determine the name for your started task from, as we saw on the previous page, the ICRIN03 or the started class. And then once that ID has been associated, you make sure you've got your OMVS segment, and that will come up and start your broker. So moving on there, if I carry on and move on to slide 11, we're at our next question, our question 3 that was submitted to us. And this, again, was more on the separation of admin tasks and user tasks. And it was a question that was, how do I secure my runtime libraries separately from my broker components? So The concepts we have here is we have an administrator that is responsible for runtime installation, so possibly SMP on ZOS or ISMP on Unixes or whatever flavor of installer we use on that particular platform. And frequently administrators want to make sure that they are the only people that can update the runtime libraries, which is a sensible rule to have. And so what we've done in Message Broker is we've separated out our concept of runtime libraries, which is where we need to install things, our installation, separate to what we call the component directory, sometimes called a broker component directory. And that is where the broker environment is stored for things like our registry, things like our configurable services, and things like our other information that we need to actually update as we have a broker. Now the broker tasks, so in ZOS terminology, the broker started tasks, and in Unix, the broker processes, don't require write authority to the runtime libraries. But we do require write authority to the component directory, because that is where we write a fair amount of information and read from it and modify things based on the various commands you have. So from this slide we can see the separation of the two tasks between the component directory that is really for the broker's runtime usage and the runtime libraries that is purely for the administrators, so for the administrators to be able to correctly administer their broker. With that, I will hand back on to Joseph for our next question.
Thank you. We'll now move on to question number 4 on slide number 12, and again back to our panel of experts.
Hi guys, it's David Coles here in Hursley, just answering question 4. Question 4 is kind of a prelude to question 5, and they both relate to SSL setup in Message Broker. So question 4 is, what format key stores does Message Broker support? Now, in Message Broker, for our SSL support, we use the IBM or Sun, depending on platform, Java Secure Socket Extension API, or JSSE for short, to provide our SSL support. And this means that we support the Java key store format of key stores, often referred to as JKS key stores. And that's the only format we currently support in Message Broker. If we can move on to slide 13, please. Then question 5 is a bit more in depth. And question 5 is, how do I verify my SOAP node configuration for transport level SSL security? So this question is very much related to version 6.1 and all the configuration options are for 6.1 only. So first of all, before you can verify your setup, I think you need to know what you need to set up and understand the way things work, so you actually know what you need to configure and why you're configuring it. So if we think about the two basic types of SSL connection, there's the one-way authorization, which is asymmetric auth or server auth, and that is where the client trusts the server. And so the client connects into the server passes back a key, which the client will then have to trust. Then there is the second type of authorization, which is symmetric auth, client auth, or two-way auth, depending on your terminology. And this is where, as well as the client trusting the server also has to trust the client. So in the handshake process here, the client will pass a key back to the server so that the server also trusts the client, as well as also the server passing the key back to the client, as in one-way auth. Now, to go onwards, I think I've just used a couple of terminologies there, which I think we need to explain. So we've got keys, is a key run, pardon the pun, and this is kind of an identity token you define, and then you pass that between the client and the server. Both sides will need to know about this key or know a signer of this key, because you can have individual keys and they can be authorized by central signer groups. And at each end, the keys are stored in key stores. When you're passing the key back, and then trust stores, which is where you check the key against a known entity. Check you know the key is valid. And there's some other terminology there. Protocols. Now this is the language that they use for the handshake. and to the initial exchange of keys when you first connect in. Then there's algorithm, which is the encryption that goes across the wire to encode the certificate when it's, or the key as it's passed from the client to the server. And then there's also ciphers, which comes in once the initial handshake has happened for the SSL connection. The ciphers are used to encrypt the data that goes between the two, the client and the server. If we can move on to slide 14 then, we can see now we're bringing that into the message broker approach. So the message broker has a good amount of configurability in 6.1 for its key stores and its trust stores. And there's three different levels you can configure at depending on what you want to achieve. So first off, there is the broker registry level where you can define key stores and trust stores. And these apply to all execution groups inside your individual message broker. And then stepping down from that, there is the execution group level. And here you can again define a trust stores, key stores, and they then apply just to that execution group. And any settings at this level will overrule those applied at the broker registry level. And then there's a third level which just applies to the SOAP input node, where you can supply a key store just for the SOAP input node. And that's at the HTTPS connector level. And again, that will override the key store set at the execution group level or the broker registry level. Now, to verify these settings, then you need to use MQSI report properties, which is a broker command for reporting properties set for at execution group level or indeed at broker-wide level. And there's a couple of examples at the bottom of the slide of how to use that command. Full details are in the info center. Now, there's a couple of defaults that apply here. If you don't define any trust stores and you're trying to do SSL, then the default trust store will be the CA cert file in the message broker JRE in the libsecurity directory of the message broker Java runtime. And so it's always worth remembering if you're looking at your installation and why something doesn't work or indeed does work, that there is the default trust store, the CA cert file. And also there's a default key store, which is a file called .keystore, and that's in the user's home directory. And so again, if you're having strange behavior or something's not working, then and you know you haven't configured a key store, then try looking there. However, we would always recommend that you do define a key store and a trust store either at the broker level or the execution group level and don't rely on the default files being there or indeed being correct. Now there is, and the way, and each key store and trust store has a password so you feel able to open it, and you can define these when you set up with change properties. If you look at the extract in the window on slide 14, then you can see we've got a broker key store file you can set to the broker registry, and also a broker key store pass value, which is set to broker key store :: password. And this is a unique identifier value, which we then look up in the broker internal password store. And so we look up the identifier broker key store :: password. And to actually define a password for this identifier, use the MQSI set db palms command. And this way the password is not stored in plain text on the file system or in memory or anywhere whilst it's stored. So also in that text on the command console window on slide 14, you can see the two levels there. You've got the broker registry where you can define your key store file and key store pass, as well as your broker trust store file and password. And you've also got the execution group level, which comes under the COM-IBM JVM manager options in set in MQSI change properties. And again, there you've got broker key store file, key store pass, trust store file, and trust store pass. So when you're trying to verify your setup, use MQSI report properties to print out these options and see what's configured. So slide 15 then, and this is how to verify your setup for SOAP input nodes, where the message broker is acting as a server for SOAP requests. Now, there's once you get into setting up, defining the flows, then there's two parts to your setup. There's the message flows part, which you define as the toolkit, and here there's the Use HTTPS option in the HTTP transport tab of the SOAP input node properties. Now you can see on the top right of this slide that the use HTTPS box is ticked. And if you want your SOAP input node to service HTTPS requests, then you need to click this box before you deploy the flow. Now if we move to the runtime, then there's several more options you need to verify. As before, on the previous slide, we talked about setting up key stores and trust stores. Now, if you're just doing one-way authorization into your SOAP input node, this is where the client connects into the server and the server passes back a key which the client needs to trust. This means you need to have configured a key store which the SOAP input node will use. And this is either configured as on the previous slide, at the HTTPS connector level, the execution group level, or indeed the broker registry level. And again, you can use MQSI port properties to check these out. If you're doing two-way authorization, then you also need to configure the other half, which is where the client will pass a key to the server, which the server needs to trust. And at this stage, you need to have configured a trust store for the SOAP input node to be able to access either at any of the three levels. And also, if you want to use the two-way authorization and make the client authorize themselves with the broker, then you need to set the client auth property in the HTTPS connector settings. Also in these settings, you can see on the right in the command console that there's settings there for SSL protocol, ciphers, key path, and key alias. So the SSL protocol and the ciphers can be set to any available Java JSSE valid values, which will then be used in the negotiation phase. And also, you can specify a key path and a key alias. So a key alias allows you to identify a certain key in a key store that you wish the SOAP input node to present to any requesting clients. And sometimes, you find that keys in a key store have a password on themselves, and this is what you set in the key path. So again, when you're verifying your SOAP input node setup, you just need to step back and think about which certificate needs to be sent where and which one you need to verify. And so you need to, again, use MQSI report properties to check this out. If we move on to slide 16, then we can see this talks about the message broker acting as a client. So SOAP request node, SOAP async request and response nodes. So this is where the message broker will connect out to a remote web service. And this almost requires the, again, as before, you've got the message flow configuration and the runtime configuration. With these, there is more to configure on the message flow if you need to. If you're in the toolkit on the SOAP request or SOAP async request nodes, in the properties, you need to configure a valid URL which starts HTTPS to initiate a HTTPS or SSL request. And you also need to check the protocol matches the protocol that the server it's connecting to will require. And the default for this, I think from 6.4 onwards, is TLS. And this is the latest and best current standard available. And so we default to that. You may find that if your server is slightly older, they may require SSL or SSLv3 in those boxes. But when you try and connect, you'll get an exception that says invalid protocol, and that's what you need to look at. If you then, also on that, you're allowed to specify some ciphers. And this will specify the cipher you wish the negotiation to happen using. And these are specified here as opposed to at the runtime, and so they can be specified individually for each request node. And also, at the runtime level, as before, we need to configure your trust stores and your key stores in very much the opposite way to as you did with the SOAP input node. And so here, if you're using one-way auth, then the server you're connecting to will pass you back a key. And so you need to have that key in the trust store that the message broker is configured to use. And if the client enforces two-way auth, then again, you will need to have configured a key store which the SOAP request node will pass outwards to the server. And again, as with everything, MQSI report properties is the way to check the settings for these at the runtime. Now, if we, I think that's the answer to that question complete. So if I can pass back to Joseph to move off to the next question.
Thank you, David. We will now move on to slide number 17 and to our last pre-submitted question, question number 6. And off to you, panel.
Okay, hi, this is Randy Miller here. I'm going to handle question number 6. It is, how do I use ACLs to properly control access to WMV runtime components? Before we get into that, I'd just like to talk a little bit about sort of what ACLs are and how they work, and then towards the end we'll have some general recommendations for setting them. But basically, access control lists are a set of rules that allow administrators to sort of control runtime objects and what users and groups get access to those objects. They're in place primarily to prevent accidental or malicious access to runtime objects that could result in unwanted changes. Obviously, this is much more important in a production environment than, say, tests, but at the same time, most shops implement them across the board. The actual access options that can be granted range from anything from view all the way up to full, and I'll make a reference into those a little bit later. And some of these actually depend on the actual object that's being controlled. So, for instance, edit does not apply to execution groups and such. So ACLs can be set in a number of different ways. You can actually set them via the Config Manager Proxy API or the sample Config Manager Proxy exerciser or via the command lines. Okay, can we move ahead one slide, please? Okay, ACLs behave in a hierarchical manner with the most specific entry taking precedence. Okay, here's an overview showing the relationships of the various members within the hierarchy, highest being the actual Config Manager Proxy. So the most authority that anyone could have would be to have full control over that, which would give you any control over anything within the hierarchy then. In this particular overview, it shows the children to be root topic and subscriptions, so it'd only ever be one of those, along with pub/sub topology, but within that can be many instances of brokers and even more instances of execution groups beneath that. ACLs are used to control any or all of those objects. Next, please. In order to make sure that the objects are controlled, we have to make sure that the ACLs are controlled. So there are a number of rules along those lines, and I'll just cover them quickly. Obviously, in order to view an ACL, you have to have view permission for that object. Okay. The same thing applies for modification. You have to have full control permission for that object in order to be able to change the ACL for it. There are a couple of IDs that get set for full Config Manager Proxy authority from the beginning, and this sort of allows administrators to use these IDs to set subsequent ACLs. And these two IDs would be the service ID or the user ID that actually creates the Config Manager, or the service ID that the Config Manager is running under. Next slide, please. Okay, here's an example that sort of hopefully we'll bring it together. And in this particular example, it shows two different ACLs set at the Config Manager Proxy level. One is for user one for domain one, and it has full control. And then user three has only view control, and you note there's no domain or machine name associated with that user. Okay, so the first ID basically has control to anything within Config Manager Proxy capability. All right, so it can view, it can do any deploys to all execution groups, it can delete, it can view properties for various components and such. It gives the example, domain 2 user 1 has no capability, all right, because there's no ACL set for it whatsoever. So it's not even going to be able to connect to the Config Manager. The last example is showing that user 3 from basically any domain coming in to the Config Manager will be given view capability for all objects within the proxy. Now, what you can also do is you can actually do combinations of things as well. So, for instance, you could have user 3, you could set it such that it has full capability for one of the execution groups within the pub/sub topology, and then it would basically have only view for everything outside of that, but full control specifically for that execution group. So there's quite a bit of capability here to control what users do what based upon what their roles and responsibilities are. Okay, next slide, please, 21. Okay, so a couple recommendations. The recommendation is for the finest level of control that you can have, you would actually set individual users in either machine or domains versus groups. Okay, now what might make a difference there is if you're managing a large group of users, then you might want to consider implementing groups. Or if you have a high turnover in your user area due to contractors, whatever, you may choose to use groups. But you can definitely get a finer level of control if you specify individuals and machines that are going to be coming into the config manager with. And for most shops that have 6 or 8 developers or such, that's usually very manageable. The other recommendation, it's sort of obvious, is to only give the least amount of access needed for an individual to perform their role. In the Info Center, we've got one of the pages in there is AP12520_, and it lists all the various access capability for every level within the proxy. And beyond that, the only other recommendation is to continually take regular backups of the Config Manager repository so that should the unthinkable happen and you lose a hard drive or something like that, you can easily recoup the configuration and the control list. So with that, I'll go ahead and turn it back to Joseph.
Thank you again to our panel of experts for answering the pre-submitted questions. At this point in time, Melissa, we would like to open the lines for live Q&A period.
And it looks like the first question is from Michael Wallace. Your line is open.
In Message Broker 6.0, the CA search file got overwritten whenever you applied maintenance. Has this been fixed in Message Broker 6.1?
This is Ralph replying. I don't believe that is fixed in 6.1. The issue comes with the replacement of the JRE. So whenever the JRE is replaced, then we end up overwriting the CA certs because that is a default file provided by Java. But we don't actually need to use that file. So if I pass over to my colleague David, then he can explain how you can change it so that you never need to use that file.
I mean, for exactly that reason, we wouldn't recommend you use the CA certs file in MB6. It is quite possible to configure the IBM Java Options environment variable to point at key stores and cluster stores that you want to use to avoid using the defaults. And I'm sure if you were to raise a PMR that got to level 2, they could tell you the exact syntax for how to do that. I can't remember it off the top of my head.
Okay, thank you. I think 6.1 has capabilities which makes that easier than 6.0.
Yes, much easier. And that applies back to the answers I actually gave to the question on question 5. And the slide 14, where you set up your trust stores at the broker registry execution group level, that avoids the need to use the defaults or the environment variable settings.
Okay. Thank you.
And I am showing no further questions. Turn it back over to you, Joseph.
Thank you, Melissa. And thank you, everyone, for your participation in the live Q&A period. At this point in time, I would like to pass the presentation back to Ralph for a summary of today's session.
Okay, good morning, everybody. Well, thank you all for joining our first Message Broker WSTE conference call. As we said throughout the slides, security is a very large topic. We've really only scratched the surface of the areas that you can make secure in the current environment with Message Broker 6.0 and Message Broker 6.1. I think, as is evident from some of the questions that we had asked and some of the questions that were pre-submitted, that the way to configure Message Broker security in 6.1 is dramatically better than the way it used to be using environment variables and other such things as we used to have to do in Message Broker 6.0. So in summary, we've looked at some of the ways to secure your environment using ACLs and using topic-based security. We've looked at how to set up the SOAP nodes and how to set up some of the information to use SSL and actually use the proper JSC security for securing your messages going back and forth through your systems and to your back-end applications. We've also looked at the different user IDs that are being used for the distributed and the ZOS product when you actually start and run the environment. And we've looked at how to secure some of the differences between a runtime and between a broker component. The question we had from the floor online live was how do we sort out the CA certs being overwritten every time you apply maintenance. And certainly our hearty recommendation on that would be not to use that default file. And either in 6.0 to use the NVARs to use a different location or to set it up properly as David showed in question 5 or 6.1. With that, I will thank you all very much for joining and participating. As Joseph has said, if there are any other topics that you would like presented, then please feel free to let us know either directly or through the WSTE links that you have. And with that, I'll turn back over to Joseph.
Thanks again, Will, for a great summary. At this time, we will conclude the Open Mic session.